All right, we're ready now for the concluding portion of our program. If you can continue to eat your lunch, obviously, but I'll introduce our luncheon speaker. It really is a distinct pleasure for me to introduce my colleague at the Manhattan Institute, David Graetzer. David, a physician, is, as I said, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. His research interests include Medicare and Medicaid, drug reimportation, and FDA reform. He's the author of the forthcoming book, The Cure, How Capitalism Can Save American Healthcare, whose cover you see displayed here. It's not out yet, but will be out anytime. He also wrote a book called Code Blue, Reviving Canada's Healthcare System, back in 1999, which was awarded the Donner Prize for Best Canadian Public Policy Book in 2000, and is now in its fifth printing. It's a very good book. I recommend it highly. David was born and raised in Canada and now divides his time between his home in Toronto and New York, where, as I indicated, he works for the Manhattan Institute. He is a physician. He graduated from the University of Manitoba, undergraduate, and also from its medical school. He's licensed in both countries. He's a board-certified psychiatrist, and so after lunch, if you have any problems you'd like to share with him, he'll be in the room next door for a brief period. But again, it is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. David Graetzer.
Thank you, EJ, for that enormously kind introduction. Listening to you talk about me, I was reminded of a comment a former colleague had made of me some years ago when he told me that, on paper, I seemed like a fascinating individual. And I'd also like to thank you very much for the invitation to speak today. I very much appreciate the efforts of the Empire Center. I think Albany is lucky to have you, EJ, and lucky to have your staff so dedicated to these issues. It was a half-inch incision, a 28-minute procedure, and generated an inscrutable foot-and-a-half-long bill. That was one of my experiences with American healthcare. I had taken my wife skiing just before our wedding. I thought it would be a nice break. It proved to be one of the most expensive ski trips of my life. My wife on the bunny hill had navigated rather poorly down and at the end of the day ruptured one of the discs in her back. Uninsured and confused, we attempted to find a neurosurgeon in Western New York. We found one, and then I attempted to find the quality of his care by cold calling neurologists and seeing if they could critique a colleague over the telephone. Needless to say, not many could. We had a choice of two hospitals and information on neither. We chose one because we liked the name more. And then we had a nervous night in Buffalo waiting for the procedure in a hotel that I had looked up on hotels.com, had perfect information on, including whether or not it had an indoor or outdoor swimming pool, a rating scale, and, of course, price comparison galore. Needless to say, I thought ironic, if deeply disconcerting, that I would be making a very modest choice or a very unimportant choice about the hotel and had so much information on the more important choice, literally something that could affect the rest of our lives. I had practically no information. After the procedure, we got this bill, as I had made mention of before. It was for an extraordinary sum of money. I called up the hospital administrator, and she told me to relax. This was really just a starting point of negotiations. Before we could negotiate, I started receiving letters from a collection agency, and finally I suggested to the hospital administrator that I would pay on the spot 10% over what the Medicare price was if she just told me the Medicare price, and she paused and she said, "I can't tell you that." I don't know of anyone who doesn't have such a story of American healthcare, not, of course, necessarily to you or your spouse, but to somebody in the family. The lack of information, the inscrutable bills, the ever-rising costs. That is, of course, at the micro level what goes on with American healthcare. But at the macro level, we know that there are significant problems. Now, most of you are involved in state government or agencies that study state government, so I won't talk about rising expenses in Medicaid. But as you're well aware, in the private sector, we're seeing a similar trend. In fact, one could argue that we are in the midst of the Bush recession. What do I mean? Well, take a look at median income. Okay, it seems a little bit odd to talk about a recession. I mean, in a recession, your economy actually recedes. That's the definition. Our economy chugs along at more than 3% a year. Unemployment is down to under 4% in parts of the country, and nationally just a little bit over 4%. And yet, if you look at median income, you discover that that people earn less than they did 5 years ago. And that's particularly ironic, given that wages are up. Why are wages are up, and yet people are making less money? Well, it has a lot to do with the fact that health premiums have more than doubled since the year 2000. And if you look at out-of-pocket expenses, what you discover is that the average American pays roughly $1,000 more. Sorry, the average American family pays roughly $1,000 more than they did in the year 2000. We are collectively dissatisfied with this. Collectively, we can't afford American health care as it spirals up, and the question is what to do. The simple answer, what is becoming increasingly attractive, not just to academics, but increasingly attractive to CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, to activists, to mainstream America, is maybe opting for some sort of a single-payer solution. In fact, somebody alluded to that earlier in one of the questions. Needless to say, in California, legislatures passed a single-payer bill, which probably will be vetoed, but they passed it nonetheless. In Vermont, they're holding an active debate. In fact, last year, 17 states have had an active debate in their legislatures about a single-payer. A lot of people think that this is the way out. Not me. I'll tell you my own experience with single-payer. I learned my most important lesson about healthcare not in the classroom, but on the way to one. I grew up in Winnipeg, and went to medical school in Winnipeg, which was smack dab in the middle of Canada. For those of you not well-nuanced with winters in Winnipeg, I would point out to you that some nights it grows so cold that it drops to 40 below, which, for those of you who are interested in trivia, would be aware that that's actually the same in Celsius as in Fahrenheit. Needless to say, when you're walking from a parking lot on a rather cold winter's day, saving a couple of minutes in time is worthwhile. And so one winter's morning on my way to med school class, I decided to cut across the emergency room, not because I found it a fascinating place, not because I'm a buff of ER and watched all of the reruns, but just because it would save me a couple of minutes. And I walked in, and I discovered an emergency room packed with people. It was one of the spectacular emergency room overcrowdings that were going on in Canada at the time. The hospital was on critical care redirect, meaning even if you literally had a heart attack across the street, they wouldn't take you. In fact, all the hospitals in Winnipeg, a city about the size of Indianapolis, were on critical care redirect for 10 hours. Emergency doctor later told me, it's simply you just don't have a heart attack in Winnipeg. And I remember just standing there and smelling the sweat and the urine and the fear that hung in the air, and thinking for the first time in my life, many of the things I had assumed about healthcare just weren't true. I mean, I was a gentleman who was born and raised in Canada and hadn't really given that much thought to healthcare. I was a Canadian and soaked up from my environment certain things, I guess a love of ice hockey, an ability to convert Celsius into Fahrenheit, and also a belief that fundamentally the government ought to do health care. I mean, that way it wouldn't be for profit, that way everyone would have access, and compared to the American model, which I didn't know a lot about but had read somewhat about, this seemed to be the compassionate and reasonable approach. I do remember the Hillary Care debates that went on in Washington in the mid-1990s, Washington, a city I'd never been to, and I remember thinking at some level, and again, this didn't arise out of great scrutiny or anything of the sort, but thinking that that was, you know, a step in the right direction. Well, when I stepped into the emergency room that day and saw what Canadian healthcare could be like, I began to re-examine things. And again, in Canada, most of the debate was between people who acknowledged there's some type of a problem and thought the way out was either you spend more money, the spendthrifts, or you manage it better. All government programs fundamentally have these two schools of thought. And initially I was a spendthrift, and then I was a magician, that is thinking you just get the incentives right, and then I became agnostic. And the reason for that was I just spent a lot of time in the hospitals in Canada and discovered more and more that there was a gap between the healthcare Canadians wanted and the healthcare they were receiving. Now, there have been so many studies that have come out since those days on heart care, on oncologic care and so on, that for me to question waiting lists now in Canada seems kind of an absurd statement to make. In fact, I decided to start writing about and raise awareness, and my conclusion of my writing was that there was something fundamentally wrong with Canadian healthcare, that it wasn't that we needed to spend more money or that we needed to manage it better, but there was something fundamentally flawed in a government-run and managed healthcare system. I started to write articles. There's a limitation to how much you can say in 700 words, even if you're very pithy. And so I thought at some point in time I would write a book. And I remember telling my parents this, and they were very supportive. We'll explore the maternal relationships later. But my mother in particular felt that I could never finish a book, but that it was good that I was going to do that. As I said, they're very supportive people, and as a result, I'm, of course, well-adjusted. I did actually finish the book, and I sent out a proposal and a book chapter to 12 publishers, and I got 13 letters of rejection. One publisher lost the chapter, so they just read the proposal, and they knew this was not the sort of thing they were interested in. No Canadian would want to read about the problems in their healthcare system, so they sent back a rejection. Then they found the book chapter, and it was as bad as they thought it was going to be. So just to make sure that I never reapplied there, they sent another letter. I finally did find a publisher who was willing to publish the book, and he explained to me that he actually didn't particularly like the book, but I was a young guy, and look, I'd already written a book. Probably at one point in time, I'd write a book that people were actually interested in reading. The book actually made a bit of a splash, and it started to sell, and today we're in our fifth printing, and it went on to win the Donner Prize, which is the highest award one can win in Canadian public policy. And what I discovered was, while politicians weren't willing to talk about this issue, a whole lot of Canadians had stumbled upon the truth, be it through a family member or through a friend or perhaps through their own personal experience, that they discovered that in Canada it's like the old Soviet system. Everything is free, it's just that nothing is readily available. And that's very amusing when you're talking about toilet tissue and Moscow in 1976, far less amusing when you're talking about, I don't know, radiation therapy in Toronto in 2006. More and more people began to speak out about it, and just last year the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that some of the laws restricting the practice of private medicine are in fact violate Quebec's Charter of Rights, which is a little bit like the Bill of Rights in the United States. There's been a huge change in Canada, in other words, in a very short period of time. Maybe even I had a little bit to do with that. But like many Canadians, I find my future now south of the 49th parallel, not north of it. And like many doctors, I'm interested in health policy. And what I find most troubling is that some of the same mistakes that have been made in Canada are increasingly being made in the United States. Look, on this we can all agree. Healthcare is very expensive here. But in order to solve a problem, and I speak now as a doctor, you got to get the diagnosis right. And I think cost is actually a symptom and not an underlying illness. What is wrong with American healthcare? Well, let me explain to you all of the problems with American healthcare and where we might go from here by citing just three dates and focusing on one person's organ. Okay, February 12, 1941 is the date that medicine changes. For those of you who are history buffs, medicine is pretty advanced in terms of physiology and anatomy by that point in time, and doctors are exquisitely limited in terms of what they can actually do. Doctors don't like you to hear that, right? Doctors like to tap into this great historical tradition, right? You go to your doctor, and on the wall is the Hippocratic Oath. Let me tell you something. What your doctor does is nothing to do with Hippocrates, except perhaps billing. What about other great traditions over time? Again, everything changed February 12, 1941, the first discovery, first clinical usage of penicillin. For those of you who are interested in reading about these sorts of things, I tell you, there's no Tom Clancy novel that compares to this story. There's a British police officer, believe his last name is Armstrong, who reaches down to pick up a letter from the ground, and he pricks his face on a rose bush, and within a couple of days it becomes infected. Within a few days he's septic, and they send him to die on the septic ward of your local hospital. You probably are unfamiliar with the septic ward because it no longer exists. Septic just simply means blood infection. And you know, it's the time of war, and this research facility decides to focus in on something a little more practical, so they focus in on penicillin. And they apply it, and on the first day, nothing happens. On the second day, nothing happens. On the third day, his fever breaks. And from that point on, all of medicine changes. I focus on penicillin because it's the first great discovery. If we'd only discovered penicillin in the 20th century, I still think it would have been the century of medicine. But after that, there's a sea of discovery. Steroids, antidepressants, antipsychotics, and so on. The list is long. And so you see medical miracles. And I use that word cautiously, but I think appropriately. Polio was suddenly confined to the history books. Childhood leukemia before a death sentence is all of a sudden eminently treatable and certainly curable for kids under the age of 12. Diseases that plagued our society no longer seem quite so vigorous. Let me give you one example, and then I'll focus on it for a minute and move on. Cardiac disease. Death by cardiovascular disease in the United States since 1950 has fallen by two-thirds. Let me put a human face on this issue. Does anyone happen to know who Dick Cheney is? We'll make this participatory. The people in the back who've fallen asleep suddenly feel very anxious. Who is Dick Cheney? He's the vice president of the United States. Once I spoke to a group of pharmaceutical executives, and I put up a picture, and no one got it. So we'll just coach you along. One finds participatory democracy works better when it's coached along. At least some people feel that way here in Albany. So Dick Cheney. Now, does Dick Cheney have any heart problems? Yes. Dick Cheney's had a heart attack, right? In fact, he's had more than one heart attack. How many heart attacks does Dick Cheney have? You can call out. I've got three up front, I've got four in the back, and somebody's waving five. If we keep bidding, we'll keep going up. It's four, okay? A couple of people over there win the game prize, which is an elegantly priced book. For heart attack. Now, look, cardiology is enormously complicated, and I can't explain all the nuances of cardiology. It takes you 15 years to become a cardiologist. Can't explain all of the nuances, except to say this. As a general rule of thumb, three heart attacks is better than four heart attacks. And as a general rule of thumb, two heart attacks is better than three, one is better. And you're all things considered, you're probably better off not having a heart attack altogether. Like I said, 15 years of higher education. This is the psychiatry bias coming on. They get better parking spots. People respect the cardiologist more. I tell you, there's not that much to the field. Dick Cheney is a great example of what you can do. The heart is effectively a pump. You can measure a pump's efficiency. Anyone hazard a guess what is the efficiency of the pump heart of an average gentleman in his 50s, 60s? It's about 75%. If you run a lot, you can get up to 80%. I just drink a lot of coffee. I'm not at 80%. Anyone want to hazard a guess what the efficiency fraction of Dick Cheney's heart is, roughly? Yeah, I've got 40, 12. So 25%. Okay. So for those of you who are registered Democrats, we've just confirmed your worst suspicions. He's not a man with half a heart. He's got a quarter of a heart. Again, I speak not to the man's politics, but to his health condition. He's had four heart attacks. He doesn't just hold down a job. He holds down full-time employment, benefits, and everything. Okay? Looking across the board, American Heart Association estimates that the average person who has a heart attack under the age of 65 has an 88% chance of returning to work. In fact, the Canadian Heart and Stroke Foundation recently came out a study looking at 1 year post-heart attack and found that roughly half of Americans actually feel better than they did in the year before the heart attack. What am I suggesting? Medicine has been revolutionized, okay? Not in the last 600 years, not in the last 500 years, literally in the last 60 years, all beginning with the first clinical use of penicillin and cascading thereon. And if medicine has changed, here's the odd thing. In so many ways, the way we understand and structure healthcare has not changed since the Second World War. I mentioned three dates, one organ. Well, we've covered one date and one organ. Let me move on. October 26, 1943. Probably the most important date if you want to understand what goes on in American healthcare. FDR did not give a speech. No legislation was passed. The Supreme Court did not rule on any single case. What happened then? The IRS issued a clarification stating that basically health expenses would remain paid in pre-tax dollars in terms of employer-based premiums. In other words, when your boss pays for your health care in terms of the insurance coverage, it'll go in pre-tax dollars. That really rises out of the wage and price controls of the Second World War. Everyone remembers the price controls because grandma used to tell you stories about the way they rationed butter. That's the consequence of rationing through price. Wage controls led to the inevitable conclusion that people needed to find ways to attract better employees, but they couldn't raise wages, right? So they would offer benefits. And health insurance seemed to be the way to go. Health care was starting to get better. People suddenly had more of an interest in health insurance, which prior to that point really was more of a sickness benefit than anything else. And more employers turned around and started to offer benefits, okay? They did this in sort of the gray zone of the law. The IRS ruled in October 26, 1943. They could continue this. This was eventually codified in the mid-1950s. And it means that for millions of Americans today, long removed from wage and price controls, long removed from FDR, most of you are still getting your health insurance from your employer. And it's in pre-tax dollars. The second major event I'd point out, also in the middle of the Second World War, early in the Second World War, was December 1, 1942, when Lord Beveridge releases his report. Lord Beveridge isn't an American, he's a British citizen, but the struggle that was going on in Britain, as in the United States, was contemplating care of the elderly, pensions of the elderly, care of citizens. And he issues a report that has profound impact on the psyche of the United States, particularly because he has so much sway within the Democratic Party and is so influential and articulate. And he points at a report basically saying, look, you should have $0 health coverage in terms of public insurance. These two events go on and have great influence, and all of a sudden in the 60s, not coincidentally, you have an age of great health inflation. Why? Because suddenly medicine is capable of doing more, and more people really aren't paying directly for their bills. And there are two big schools of thought that rise out of the 1960s, and they're represented by two men, Wilbur Mills and Richard Nixon. And today, if you want to ask me who are the two most important people in American healthcare, I would say Wilbur Mills and Richard Nixon, not just because they both retired in scandal in 1974. The reason I would pick these two men is because in the middle of the 1960s, looking at that health inflation, looking at the problems that are rising, Wilbur Mills championed Medicare and also snuck in the bill Medicaid, and that has a profound impact on how Americans receive their health coverage. In fact, today, roughly 50 cents on every health dollar spent in the United States is spent out of public purses. Those of you who think that this is a free market, private system. It ain't so. This is a quasi-socialist system. The other person to have influence was the Republican answer to the health inflation was not more government but managed care. And the person who really took this West Coast idea that no one had ever thought of seriously, no one had really seen as being a solution to the problems of American healthcare was Richard Nixon. 1969, he uses the C word for the first time, crisis. People all over the Republican Party and all over America are clamoring for some sort of a single-payer system, including Nelson Rockefeller, and is kind of a compromise between the unfettered market and more government. Richard Nixon embraces a West Coast idea, Kaiser Permanente, and the whole managed care phenomenon. Previous to that point in time, HMOs were considered left coast and a little bit flaky. He takes it and turns it into a Republican idea. Doesn't catch off right away, though. Boy, did they subsidize it in those early days, the HMO Act of 1973, and then just for good measure turning around and doing the same thing again 5 years later. But what captures the imagination of people on Main Street, or at least their employers, is the fact how that health inflation keeps going up through the 1980s. Medicine keeps going better. People aren't paying directly out of pocket. And all of a sudden, people are interested in getting a whole lot of health care. And that is why the whole temptation of managing care. Well, as you know, managed care was really managed cost, and that's really fallen by the wayside. But now we're in a strange period. Because in so many ways, Americans know what they don't want, managed care, and yet we're not really sure quite how to proceed. We are, in a sense, not unlike those countries in Eastern Europe after the collapse of the Berlin Wall. Everyone could agree what didn't work. No one knew quite how to proceed. My book is about proposing simple ideas, but maybe this is the ultimate summary of the book. In 5/6 of the economy, you know what works. Deregulation, a vibrant private sector, individual choice, and competition. Do you really wonder what ought to be done in that other 1/6 of the national economy? Let me just give you a couple of very simple examples. Your boss no longer wants you to provide health insurance. You want to buy an individual insurance plan. Have you ever looked at what it's like to buy an individual insurance plan in New York? It's incredibly expensive. Not if you're advanced in age, not if you are sick, but even if you're a young, healthy, strapping guy who, unlike me, doesn't drink coffee at all and exercises all the time. Take the train, the Metro Line North, out of Manhattan to Connecticut, and you can buy an individual policy for 1/4 the price. want to shop around for health care. Again, in so many states, including this one, there's practically no vibrant competition, certainly within the hospital sector, because it's so carefully managed by government. What do I mean? Why don't you and me, we open up a hospital? You can't do that because of certification of need laws. So much of American health care is riddled either in government spending, which incidentally is largely price controlled, something you'd never try to put in the rest of the economy, or it's heavily regulated by government. What is the end result of this? An upside-down world, a world that works in no way, shape, or form like the rest of the American economy. Your doctor tells you you need an MRI, somebody proposed earlier in a question. How do you shop around? There's so few prices available. You want to check out quality? How would you do that? The reason why you can't do that is because there is no healthcare consumer. Okay? There is a healthcare payer, and there is competition in the American healthcare system, except it's at the insurance level. That is a terribly unsatisfying approach. Now, we have 15 minutes for questions and answers. I'm delighted to talk further about some of my ideas for the uninsured, for employer-sponsored care, for Medicare and Medicaid. But look, let me just finish with one last idea, okay? What's oil trading at today? It's a little bit down from where it was a couple months ago. What is it, $60 today? These are the people who are speculating on oil futures. They knew immediately, okay? Who drives an SUV? Somebody here must have an SUV and be able to rattle off what oil is a barrel. Oil is very high historically, am I correct? America has an energy problem, am I correct? Okay. You might think that there's an energy problem because we ought to recycle more and tap into wind power. Okay. You might think that there's an energy problem because we ought to drill Alaska. You might think that there's an energy problem because of the Middle East. You and I will get together later and we'll have drinks. But we can all agree that there's an energy problem. In the 1970s, there was also an energy problem, and that was debated in what was the solution to gas prices, price controls, okay? Richard Nixon stood up in 1971, and he stood up, we are all Keynesians, okay? And the younger people in the group have no idea who Keynes was, okay? He stood up and basically said, we all are socialists now, and he believed in price fixing, and off he went, and he fixed gasoline prices. Today, the problems are just as significant in terms of gas prices. In fact, by historical standards, they might be even higher. No one would stand up and say, we are all Keynesians and we ought to do price fixing. And yet those of you who are governing over Medicaid in this state, and those of you who have friends in Washington who govern over Medicare know we are all price fixers now when it comes to public insurance in the United States. And the private system is equally anemic. We have to take a fresh look at this. Why? Because the costs are going up, yes, but because the underlying system is unsound. It produces high cost, low satisfaction health care. And Americans deserve better. Your questions? I'm in psychiatry. I'm simply excited at this time of the day to have a microphone. Usually I'm sitting listening. I can talk all afternoon. Soon I could explore my childhood. My well-adjusted childhood. However, if there are questions, I'm delighted to answer.
David, let me start just to get to prime the pump, if you will. A gentleman in the previous, after the previous panel, asked a question about documenting whether outcomes in Canada are poor compared to those in the United States. Cardio and cancer, I believe he asked about. Could you explain to me what your answer to that would be?
First of all, there aren't a huge number of studies doing cross-border comparisons, but there are some studies. Heart and Stroke Foundation of Canada, as an example, looked at care and outcomes 1 year out of a heart attack. There's actually relatively little difference in terms of morbidity. There is a huge difference in terms of, not a huge difference in mortality, how many people die. There's a big difference in terms of morbidity, how well people feel. Cancer outcomes one can find by, for instance, going to the WHO, and they carry a lot of cancer outcomes. I think the way these things get confused is that people look at crude indicators like life expectancy and infant mortality. And they say, well, life expectancy in the United States, as an example, trails that of Canada. Therefore, that has great comment on the healthcare system. It's just not that simple. Diet, exercise, lifestyle choices, these things breaks my heart as a doctor to say this, often have much more impact on health outcomes than the healthcare system. But if you look at when a person is diagnosed with an illness, what is the end result? Just as an example, a prostate cancer, something I wrote in the Wall Street Journal not that long ago when one of these studies came up. Prostate cancer in the United States, the mortality rate is about 12-15%. Again, this is off the top of my head. You can look in my book and I'll cite the study. If you look at Canada, it's much closer to 25%. If you look at Britain, it's actually pushing at 50%. Why? Because, you know, if as just to pick Britain, if you're diagnosed in Britain, you're much less likely, you have a 50-50 of even seeing an oncologist. They're much less aggressive about treating elderly people. Look, I'm not suggesting that this is a perfect system. I've written an entire book about the problems of American healthcare and what are some solutions. But I think, as I've suggested before, if you really want to solve a patient's problem, you need to get the diagnosis right in the first place. And so many people look at the American healthcare system and they say, well, it's because we have private corporations or we, God forbid, have for-profit institutions. You have that in 5/6 of the economy. You have that for food, clothing, shelter, and you have no problems there. Your problems with healthcare are different and unique. You will not find your solutions in socialism. In fact, I would point out that in a lot of socialized systems, you find that they're now talking about market reforms. In Canada, a private clinic opens up at the rate of about one a week. In Stockholm, Sweden, they privatized one of the largest hospitals there. I mean, if in Stockholm, in Saskatoon, they're willing to talk about Adam Smith, I don't know why you guys are so fixated on socialism. Sir?
Sheridan Biggs again from the Union Graduate College. It's possible, I think, as you talk, to foresee what it is you're talking about. Does your book going to include a chapter on making the change? How we get there?
Any good author will tell a question or whatever he wants to hear at this point in time. Not only do we talk about that, sir, but this book is very elegantly priced on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Your niece and nephew are talking about fire engines for Christmas, but what they really want is a simple, readable 200-page book with a very elegant foreword by Nobel laureate Milton Friedman. Look, I think what I wanted to do in this very quick introduction to this topic was talk about what's really going on and where we move from here, okay? What would I do individually, just quickly? Look, employer-sponsored health insurance. If the problem is that Americans are over-insured, you have to move decisions back to the individual. I see a lot of change coming about with consumer-driven healthcare. Again, that's become such a cliche now. I mean, even Hillary Clinton can co-author a piece with Bill Frist saying that they both believe consumers should be more empowered, yada, yada, yada. But I think that the fundamental concept of making health insurance just regular insurance, okay? What would car insurance be like if it covered everything? I mean, right now, your car insurance is, what, $1,000 deductible, $500 deductible, whatever. What it doesn't cover is gas. What it doesn't cover is nicks and scratches. What it doesn't cover when your wife is kind of tired with the color, she turns to you and says, Blue, what a stupid idea for a car. You should have bought a red car, as my wife explained to me the other day. My car insurance will not pay for that, okay? If my car insurance did, it would be very expensive. Health insurance ultimately needs to move back to that concept of covering you for unforeseen things. Right now, American health insurance really covers you for three things, right? It's three packages rolled into one. One is catastrophic care, okay? Insurance, right? You're hit by a bus, God forbid, your insurance covers it. The second thing it gives you is basically prepaid benefits, okay? Historically, this is your way around taxes, particularly when marginal tax rates are really high in the 60s and early 70s. You get lots of income without lots of income tax, okay? The third thing your insurance provides you with is like a Sam's Club card, okay? You walk into the hospital and you don't get stuck with that stupid bill I got stuck with because you've got this insurance deal. So what we need to do is return insurance back to its original mandate. That is a very awkward and difficult transition. One of the questioners had asked, you know, how do you do that when there's so little information available? I think the solution to that problem is not going to be found in government legislation, though if you look at Wisconsin, people look at price transparency legislation. I think you'll solve many of these problems by just having a lot of people enrolled in consumer-driven plans, okay? And I talk about that in book, and I talk about the deregulation that would make it possible. Medicaid, you know, the experimentation in Florida, the proposals in South Carolina make a lot of sense to me. Medicare, I mean, I thought that debate was much further along a decade ago. I thought the Bro-Frist ideas or Bro-Thomas ideas made a lot of sense. You don't want a top-down, government-run, price-controlled system. Turn it over to private insurance companies and let them compete, not unlike the way they compete for the federal employees, okay? Again, that's not the solution. Too many people in healthcare always try and sell you a one-size-fits-all solution, okay? This is a step in the right direction. And the uninsured, I mean, again, a complicated problem in part because so many people who are uninsured are different than you think. I mean, you know, the way some liberals write about the uninsured, you would think that these are the people who stepped off the set of Les Miserables. In fact, a third of the uninsured have incomes above $50,000 a year. A third of them already qualify for Medicaid or Medicare or some other government program. A third of them are without insurance or the working poor, but tend to get insurance within 6 months to a year. But, I mean, I think there's that core group you need to identify and use government programs much more effectively. Again, I don't think these are insolvable problems. The reason why they seem so insolvable is because so many people in the United States are just in this box. Costs are going up. What are we going to do? What are we going to do is apply some market forces. Sir.
If the solutions in your book are anything like the speed of your speech, we're going to solve everything real fast.
A coffee every morning. It's my diet plan. Look how thin and strapping I am. Tall, too, for the people watching at home.
There we go. I'm Mark Levitt, and you're a psychiatrist, and so I want to ask you about behavior. And I ask from the point of view of everyone in our country has criticisms of our government and our politicians, but everyone likes their local politician. Everyone knows that smoking and obesity are bad for your health and you're going to die sooner, but maybe it doesn't really seem to change anything.
Right.
So why would efficient solutions about healthcare choice and money really work, or would they?
Well, there are two points you make. One is you're saying you're not totally sold on prevention, right? I mean, for how long have we known, say, smoking is bad for your health? I mean, since 1958, 59, right? And yet people still choose to smoke. And some of my colleagues say, you know, it's just about emphasizing prevention. Now, I don't do a lot of primary care anymore, but I've never sat down with an adolescent who started to smoke, and I said, listen, buddy, do you know smoking causes cancer? And they look at me in the eye and they say, you're kidding. No one's ever explained this to me before. Why? Because teenagers and people in their 20s are immortal, right? People die in auto accidents all the time. You can reduce mortality rates by wearing a seatbelt, but it turns out you'll never be in a car accident if you're 25, right? Smoking causes cancer. Somebody's uncle might have died of cancer, but they themselves will never die of cancer because that's what happens to other people. Look, I think there are limits to what can happen with prevention, though I would point out some studies in some areas have emphasized good things.
Prevention, I'm telling you, anything that's good for you that makes sense,
yes.
Will people do it?
But I would distinguish between health and healthcare, okay? What we have to do is solve America's healthcare problems. That doesn't necessarily mean we'll make people smarter, smoke less, drink less alcohol, and be thinner, okay? That is a separate set of issues. That speaks to the overall issue of public health. But why do I think these solutions would apply well to the healthcare system and people would respond to incentives? Because, sir, that's what they do in the other 5/6 of the economy. Okay. When you deregulate, when you empower people to make decisions, when you offer more competition and more choice, over time, amazing things happen. Okay. With every other good and service, science advances, and prices fall. Let me just give you an example. You're a smart attorney. You have a computer on your desk.
Yes.
Good man, I'm a doctor. I don't have a computer on my desk. All right. So it's good that you're at the podium and not this gentleman over here because he probably doesn't have a computer on his desk. The computer on your desk, you had a computer for a while, I'd imagine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You had a computer for, say, the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to put you on the spot. You're an attorney. You probably like being on the spot. But I don't want to put you too much on the spot. Just off the top of your head, is the computer today better or worse than it was 20 years ago?
Better.
Yeah. Faster, more efficient, doesn't crash all the time.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, your capacity to do things are much greater. You can do desktop publishing, whereas 20 years ago, that was a fad that really you couldn't work out too well with the clip art. You can go on the internet, right? Trade stocks, look at naughty photos, whatever you want to do. Your capacity to do things with your computer is significantly better, and the cost fell with time. That is what happens in a market economy with every other sector of the economy.
But health... just like with smoking and other things, is not the same.
It's not the same. Distinguish between the two. Public health is not healthcare. The reason why costs don't fall in healthcare is because for so many people using the system, they don't care. When you walk into your doctor's office, is there a list of prices? Now, I don't know if there's a list of prices at your law office. Okay, some lawyers do that. But if I asked you how much is this going to cost to get me a will, We should talk later. My views are controversial. I probably should have an updated will.
I'm from New York.
I asked you, for Priceless, you could provide it. If you went to your local doctor and you said, listen, you're suggesting, you know, I go on whatever fill-in-the-blank lipid-lowering drug because I eat fatty foods, he probably couldn't answer that, right? That is the problem of a market that's not working well. And I think rather than saying, look, healthcare is inscrutable, it'll never be fixed, let's look at the miracle solution of what goes on in Canada or increasingly liberals in the United States do, what goes on in Europe, that's not going to get you further ahead. But look at telecommunications or banking. Look at the advances that have gone on there in terms of customer friendliness and the ability to access service.
Could I interrupt you just to try and give it a human feel? One of the earlier speakers this morning talked about how we spend so much on home care, and yet we have to balance the economics of whether spending on home care is better in terms of avoiding, you know, nursing home care and stuff like that. But, you know, there's two sides to that equation, and the dollars isn't necessarily the only one. So what I'm trying to ask you more about is this difference between healthcare dollars versus rest of the 5/6 of the economy dollars.
But the problem is right now we spend more and more on healthcare and it's swallowing up more and more, right? I mean, health spending is now pushing well past 16% of GDP, but I don't know if we're better off for it. Right? I mean, it's not about a trade-off, okay? You're getting a trade-off right now, but I'm not sure you're necessarily further ahead. In 2000, the United States spent 14% roughly of GDP. Now it's 16%. Is your healthcare really a seventh better? Are your outcomes a seventh better? I would argue to you it isn't. In fact, I brought up cardiac care before. In fact, David Cutler, who's a very prominent economist at Harvard and advised Hillary Clinton when she was looking at healthcare, is very enamored with the idea of looking at costs and benefit ratios, okay? Okay. He does some crude data, and what he's basically said is if you take a look at the advances from 1950 to 1996, okay, that was his cutoff date, you will find that Americans paid more for health care, but they lived a lot longer and they felt better. And with cardiac care alone, it was worthwhile. If you go back a number cruncher, somebody recently did in the Journal of Health Affairs, and look from 1996 on, you find that we spent a lot more on cardiac care and the health outcomes actually have plateaued out. So I'm not suggesting to you that there aren't difficult decisions ultimately to be made with an aging society. What I am saying is that I don't know if we need to even have those discussions right now. That what I am saying is your employer-sponsored plan is going up 10-15% a year, I'm not sure you're getting 10-15% more quality. In fact, that health inflation really reflects a fundamental economic problem, okay? And until you address that problem, you're going to continue to get health inflation. And I would point out, and this is where I think some people in the United States fall into a trap, that problem isn't just in the private sector. In fact, you see it in the public sector, which is why if you look historically, health inflation in Medicaid and Medicare is very high, right? Is a little bit lower than the private sector. But, you know, administrators in Medicare cheat. They price control. Other questions?
Fred Goldstein. Excuse me, I have to run real quick after this. But I've heard you talk about it. The Wall Street Journal talked about it yesterday in that case about consumer-directed plans. And this is the fear about moving everyone into it instantly or quickly and then assuming that's going to change the system. It's not about cost. When I walk into the doctor's office, I want to know the cost, but I want to know, you know, he managed 50 patients with diabetes and their A1C's got better. I know that with a car. I mean,
absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
And so that's what I think is missing from the whole equation. And how do we get to that point where we actually start producing and reporting on true outcome measures that can then be used by, hopefully,
sure,
at that point, a health-literate population, which we know we don't have, to make real decisions about healthcare, not just cost-based decisions. Essentially, a CDP plan, these consumer-directed things, are putting the control for rationing the costs on the uninformed consumer.
I don't totally agree with that. I mean, I don't totally disagree with what you've said. I mean, there are a lot of aspects of American healthcare where you can already price compare. Greg gave a great example with regard to, you know, he went to his doctor, and the doctor said, you need a drug. And he was prescribed a script, and then he went and he researched it. In fact, with most pharmaceuticals, your ability to price shop and to compare quality is great. There are a lot of studies comparing drugs and so on, and you can make your own decisions. You're right, though. This is an awkward transition.
But you think it needs to go back a little further,
yeah,
because we already know, based on what we've seen around practice patterns in the Dartmouth study, that maybe the doctor even telling you needed that drug was wrong. So how do you know that the doctor in the first place is doing the right thing so you can begin to make the right decision to move it that way?
Right now, you have very little understanding of what your doctor is telling you, right? I mean, that's why when you look at those studies asking people to rate their doctor, it has a lot to do with stuff that you don't think is that important. He smiled. He sat down. He looked at me. Sure, he only spent 2 minutes, but he seemed to really care for that 2 minutes when he wasn't talking about how busy he was and how he's behind schedule, and he's terribly sorry about that. Look, I mean, that is a difficult transition to make. I would point out, though, that groups like the LeapFrog group are doing very interesting things in terms of surgery outcomes. It doesn't necessarily have to come from the private sector. I think some public sector initiatives have been very exciting, like the report cards on cardiac care in New York. And by the way, when you look at that, just to cite one example, yeah, fine, people change their mind, okay? In fact, when you give meaningful information to patients, they stop saying, well, I went to that cardiac surgeon because he had a pretty tie. And they start saying, I went online, I looked at the outcomes in terms of mortality, and I said, well, I'd rather not die, so I went to the center.
So then, what I'm afraid is we get too far out in front of it with the CDP, and then what happens is this. 5 years down the road, the patient says to himself, you know, if I only would have known, I'd be living longer because they didn't tell me that. I didn't have that information when I made that health decision. So I mean, we've got to get the quality data out as quickly as the price data, or you're going to have people making their decision solely on price.
I will see your pessimism and raise you one. It is more than just having data available and more than just having insurance plans out. And I think this is something Greg touched on, which I really support. It's also about having a cultural change, right? I mean, that front page story, I'd invite you guys to look at it from the Wall Street Journal, was about people all of a sudden having health care dollars saying, hey, I'm paying for my own medications all of a sudden. I want a good deal, but I don't know what to do. So they show up in the manager's office. But I would tell you, if you're ever going to try and make that transition, today in an age of the internet is a great time to do it. Because in so many other aspects of the economy, you've had a consumerization, okay? And you're seeing that in medicine, for better and for worse. I sit down with a patient, and I'm about to explain to the family why a lithium trial is appropriate, and they brought in clippings, okay? And that's a good thing, and it's a bad thing. Okay? What's a good thing? On the internet, you have access to the latest medical data, the most prestigious medical journals, not just the abstracts, the whole articles. What's the bad thing? I mean, every crazy conspiracy theory under the sun is available on the internet, how lithium is tied to fluorination in California, which inevitably leads us back to George W. Bush, right? It's every conspiracy theory on the internet much. But I think that we're taking these steps. In fact, unlike the managed care phase of the 1990s, I don't think we're seeing consumer driven plans drive up so sharply in enrollment. I think they're happening slowly. And I also think that increasingly people are aware, and this is another push, that, hey, you know, my company is putting more and more money into wages, but I'm not taking home more and more because it's getting sucked up by healthcare. I think people are beginning to question that. I'm not arguing that this is a simple, easy transition. I think particularly out of Washington, people give these glib speeches that, you know, Republicans passed HSAs, our problems are solved. We haven't even begun, in my view, to talk meaningfully about Medicare in the last 10 years. I think Medicaid is another thorny issue. But I do think that because these issues are so thorny, there's that temptation to find a simple solution. And God, single payer is simple. But so is Soviet agriculture.
Thank you, David, very much. Thank you. Thank all of you. I'm going to conclude again by promoting two web addresses, one you've all heard of, Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, and look for The Cure and put in your pre-order. I've taken care of your commercial for you. The other one is www.empirecenter.org. which is where we will post all the material we have in our hands associated with this conference, starting with the PowerPoints, in case you didn't get a print copy, and ultimately we'll be posting the video and audio record of the proceedings. Thank you very much for joining us. Have a good day.